She was 2 years old, and the day he died, when we'd been gathered with other family members and all the people in the house, she held the phone and she tried like to dial a number. And I said to her, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I want to call Kosai. Where he is? I missed him." And that was so hard for me. I had to explain that for her, and that we lost her brother and she can't see him again.
She went into a safe room at 6:30 in the morning. From there, she talked to a lot of people. She engaged with other people. She gave an interview to the radio from inside the safe room. And she told me she was angry with the broadcaster. Why? Because he tried to make her see only one side. And even in her circumstances, in the safe room, knowing that something catastrophic is happening, she didn't give up her views.
Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Parents Circle Families Forum, a joint Israeli-Palestinian organization of over 700 families, all of whom have lost an immediate family member to the ongoing conflict. The title of this series, Holding On to Humanity. In each episode, we will meet two members of families who lost their loved ones, one from the Israeli side, one from the Palestinian side. Today, we're meeting Laila Asher. Hello, Laila.
Hello, it's nice to meet you. And nice to speak to you.
Nice to meet you as well. Laila lives in the Bethlehem area of the West Bank. In 2002, her son, Kusai, only 6 months old, died after Israeli soldiers prevented Laila from taking him to the hospital. Since then, she has devoted her time and energy to ensuring a better, more peaceful future and worked extensively with the PCFF. Also with us today, Yonatan Zeigen. Hello, Yonatan.
Hi, Jonathan.
Yonatan's mother, renowned peace activist Vivian Silver, was killed in the Hamas attacks on October 7th in her home in Kibbutz Be'eri. She was 74 years old.
So, hi, Yonatan and everyone. I know you, Yonatan, because I know your mother. And she's one of my best friends. And that was so hard for everyone who knows her. And, you know, the whole story was so hard for everyone to know what happened to her. And after I heard that you joined the Parent Circle, I thought many times to meet you and to talk to you, but finally we met and we will be together in the United States next month.
Mm-hmm.
Robbie.
Yeah.
So happy to meet you. And by the way, I have 5 children and 2 grandchildren.
Wow.
You have grandchildren. Unbelievably, you look so young, but tell us about your children and tell us about Kusai.
What if the most thing that I said to Robbie, she is my other colleagues, when we have a dialogue meeting, sometimes I feel jealous because she have many memories with her son, but I have a short memory with my son. He was clever. He was funny. He tried always to play with his toys, try to discover everything, even if he was just 6 months old. And, you know, when you have children, you start to think about their future and how they will look like and what the things that they want to study. Or at that short time for me, I love it, but I wish if that was much longer than that. My other children, I have 2 girls and 3 boys. My oldest daughter, she was older than Kosai. She know the whole story. And when I become member in the forum, she refused. And she asked me many times to quit. And it was so hard for me to explain to her why I do this. Because sometimes as parents, when we have this kind of tragedy, we thought that if we didn't talk to our children about it, it's kind of, we protect them. We didn't want them to be part of the cycle of violence. We didn't want to lose them. And we thought this is the perfect way to protect them. And I discovered that it's wrong. because we should talk to them. Yeah, it's hard sometimes. You try to find the way. And when I really talked to them, not really talked to them exactly, but like 3 years ago, we have the Memorial Day. Maybe we will talk about it later. I was one of the speakers, and I spoke about his story. And when I returned back, my children saw that by Zoom. And I was really terrified when I get to my house, because I didn't know what their reaction will be. And she was the one who opened the door. And I just looked at her, didn't say anything. And she came forward and she said to me, "Just now I understand why you were doing this. And I'm so proud of you." And she came and hugged me and I started to cry. And I felt if my children could understand that, everything will be easier for me. And that gave me much more power and courage to continue.
How old was she at the time that he was killed?
She was 2 years old. And the day he died, when we being gathered with other family members and all the people in the house, she hold the phone and she tried like to deal a number. And I said to her, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I want to call Kusai where he is. I missed him." And that was so hard for me. I had to explain that for her. And then I said to her, "He's with God now." And she said to me, "I want to go with him." I said, no, please don't say that." And imagine how much that hurt. How to explain for a 2 years child that we lost her brother and she can't see him again.
Yeah.
And for like 3 months, she have a girl and she looked like exactly like her brother.
Now, recently, 3 months ago?
Yes.
This and is your granddaughter.
Yes, my granddaughter. And she called me because she have her in Jerusalem and I couldn't be with her because I couldn't have permission to visit her. And she said to me, "Mommy, she looked like Kusai exactly." And I said, "Oh my God, just please send me a picture right now." And she said, "Wow, it's like God returned him back again to us." And you know, sometimes, you know, we try to think like that because we want to encourage ourselves to memorize them or think about them all the time. Like these days, sometimes when I saw there are not children anymore, but the people who are at his age, they finished their study and some of them start to have their own work. I always think if he's still alive, how he will look like and what he is doing now. And this is so hard for me.
He would have been after 22, 20, something like that?
Yes.
Do you want to or can you take us back to that day? Do you want to tell the story for people to know?
Yeah. That night, the Israeli soldiers came to our village and they threw tear gas because some problems happened. And after maybe 1 hour or 2 hours, he became so sick because, as you know, he was just 6 months. And we live in a village outside Bethlehem. And the treatment in our village at that time wasn't good enough. So we tried to take him to a hospital in Bethlehem. Well, the Israeli soldiers prevented us because at that time they were the fighters was hide inside the Nativity Church and they closed all Bethlehem and they didn't allow anyone to go inside or go out from Bethlehem. So they told us it's a military zone, you can't enter. So we went to Hebron, the next city, to Bethlehem. But again, they told us that the main road is closed. So we tried to take him by using rough and long road between villages. And again, for the third time, there's an Israeli soldier stopped us for more than 4 hours, searched the car, searched the ID of my husband and my father-in-law. And I've been really terrified because I think if they ask me about my ID and they find that I don't have it, maybe they will take me to jail or they send me back to Jordan and I will never see my children again. And imagine my son died between my arms. And I thought about that. So many thoughts in my head. So I tried to talk to him in English and explain that our son should be in a hospital as soon as possible. But they start to laugh and they just start to talk between themselves. And after they allow us to move and we reach the hospital, the doctor said it's too late to save his life. And if he's still alive, he will be handicapped. And for a mother, one of the first thing that you start to think how you should protect your children. And in that time, I felt I'm hopeless. I couldn't do anything to protect my son. And this is one of the hardest feelings that you could ever have in your whole life. I start to cry like crazy, didn't know what to do to him. And then a few minutes later, they take him to the intensive unit care because his condition become much worse and worse. And at that night, at 5 o'clock exactly, they called us and they said, "We are so sorry. He died." Until today, I felt those words was like a bullet comes to my heart, smash it down for many pieces. I start to cry like crazy, didn't know what to do. And the house was, after like 5 minutes, full of people, relatives, neighbors, friends, people that I don't know even. But for me, I don't care about any one of them. I just care about my son. Then I start to convince myself. When we return back home, I slept in the car and this is just a dream. I will wake up and bring my son back and everything will be great. But unfortunately, that was the truth. But I have a dream that at that night, I saw a white dove came and stand at my shoulder and said to me, "Mama, don't cry. I'm so happy. I know that he's with God and he's happy." But I didn't understand why he came as a white dove. And I couldn't stop crying from that day until today. Every time I think about him or even speak about him, because he's a piece of my heart. And next day in the morning, when they bring him back to say goodbye for him, until the moment that they put him between my arms to say goodbye for him, I thought that he's still alive. And they just lie for some reason. And when I take his blanket off, because that was the first time we've been separated, I missed him so much. And when I looked at him, he was very blue and he was very cold. And I thought if I hug him so tight, he will be warm enough and he will go back to life. But unfortunately, they just take him away from me. And I felt that someone take my heart with him from that day. His grave in front of our house, it's not near, but I could see his grave from my house. Many times my husband asked me to go to visit his grave and I refuse. I say, I can't go there because if I will go there, maybe I will never come back again. I will stay there because I can't imagine that my son under the ground and he's alone there and I could leave him. And the hardest thing after these 3 days we spent it in my family law in their apartment, because our apartment above their apartment. When we returned back home, when I opened the door, the first thing I saw his toys, his stroller, and that was so hard for me. And even for maybe 2 weeks, every time I've been in the kitchen or cleaning other places, I heard his voice crying. I went to his bed and I found it empty. And I thought that, or everyone around me thought I'd become crazy. And one day my husband came and he started to take his bed out and we fight. And I said to him, "Why you are doing this?" And he said, "If you will stay like this, you will be really crazy." And we fight, and I said to him, "The Israeli take him from me, and now you want to take his memories." And I blame him for many things. And sometimes when we feel of hatred and anger, we didn't know how to deal with other people, even the closest persons. And I thought that I'm the only one who lost him, and like his dad didn't care about that. But one day I saw him, he cried a lot, and I blame myself about the things that I told him about, and I apologized for him. And after that, he tried to convince me to have another child for 3 years, and I refused. And one day, the doctor asked me why you didn't want to have children. And I said to him, why I will have them? If finally I will lose them, if not in early age, maybe after they become older, somehow they will be part of the cycle of violence. And if they are not being killed, maybe they will win to jail for the rest of their life. And I don't want that. But finally, we had another boy, and we named him Hussein too. Because even my mother said to me, don't give him that name, this is not good. I said, no, this is the only thing that I want to do, because I want to always remember what happened to him. Every time I call his name, every time I look to his eyes, I don't want to forget that.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing the story. And well, I'll turn to Yonatan at this point. And you mentioned the feeling that is common to the two of you of losing someone. And when she says, Yonatan, when she says it's the same thing if you lose a child or you lose a parent, is it the same thing, do you think? Or are there differences?
I can't really know because I didn't lose a child. I just lost a mother, but I don't think it's the same. I listening now to Laila speak, I was really heartbroken in a very deep sense. My mother had a full life, and there is something natural, not about the way she died, but about children burying their parents and not the other way around. But we do, I do believe we share some commonalities of losing a loved one, losing a family member who you feel a unique connection to, that is different than any other connection from with other people in the world. And the circumstances of violence, losing it to violence and to senselessness, something that could have been prevented and that wasn't. And I admit that also listening to Laila, I felt ashamed and sorry for our reality here between Israel and Palestine and the power dynamics.
Can you tell us about your mother and the work that she did? We know that she knew Laila, and we know that stories like this affected her deeply, and she committed herself to telling the world these stories, right? To be active in the dialogue between the two people. This is what you grew up on. Like this is the way to be. This is the only way to be.
Yeah. She was born and raised in Canada, but she came to Israel in 1974 as a part of a youth movement group. And they, back then, you know, they didn't have this clash between being a Zionist and being and believing in a better world and equity and stuff like that. It was different back then. And she came with these ideals and view of the world, and her group reestablished a kibbutz in Israel, and she was always very active. It was a part of her identity. Then we moved to Be'eri when I was 2 years old, and because they wanted a stable kibbutz. Kibbutz she formed was falling apart, and she became familiar with cross border because she was looking at the border. And
can you tell people who don't know the region about Be'eri, the location, how close it is to Gaza, what you grew up seeing?
Be'eri is about 4 kilometers from Gaza, from from the nearest refugee camp there. And you can see it when you go out to the fields. You look on Gaza, where, or you, when you're standing on the roof of a building in the kibbutz, you can see Gaza. And there were different periods of time where Gaza wasn't such a distant thing. It wasn't so closed. In the 90s, she started running an organization that had a lot of projects in Gaza. Encounter groups and economical projects and civil society training and stuff like that. So she had colleagues there and friends there. And that, you know, when I was there, she took me on to visit her friend.
And she also worked with people from Gaza who would come to Be'eri, right, to work in the kibbutz.
Well, that was when in the beginning of the 90s, she ran the construction department of Be'eri. So there were workers from Gaza who would work in construction in Be'eri. And I remember them like uncles. They became very integrated in the community, not only because of Vivian. They really, I mean, after they couldn't come to work anymore, Be'eri, the community kept on raising money for them maybe even till October 7th.
Did Vivian, your mother, was she an optimist? Was she one of those people that was all about, I'll keep doing the work, I'll talk to the people, I will make peace, it will be good here?
Yeah. Yeah, I would tease her, you know, because she never stopped. She ran the organization for 15 or 17 years.
And she never thought about living in another place.
No. And then after she retired, she, you know, I thought maybe she'll rest and knit sweaters for my kids. but she never stopped. And I would tease her and say, what are you burning yourself on something that has no no prospect? And she would say, what do you mean? It can happen tomorrow. We just have to continue the work. And if we don't do it, then it certainly won't happen.
Mm. Do we know about your mom on October 7th? Did her life's work and did her experience in any way shape her reaction to what was going on? Did she talk to people? What did she try to do? Do you know about her last day?
Yeah, I was with her on the phone through that morning. She went into her safe room at 6:30 in the morning, and from there she talked to a lot of people. She wrote a lot of people. She engaged with a lot of people. She gave an interview to the radio from inside the safe room, and you listened to the interview, and she told me she was angry with the broadcaster. Why? Because he tried to make her see only one side. And even in her circumstances, in the safe room, knowing that something catastrophic is happening.
That the people outside want to kill her or want to take her.
She didn't give up her views, her way of analyzing the world. And she tells them, you know what? Let's wait. You know, if I get out of here, if I survive, then we'll have a complex and deep conversation about two sides or one side. And the way we talked through the morning, you know, a lot of humor and the ability to recognize the situation. You know, there was some point I heard the gunshots and yelling outside of a window. And I asked her, so what's the protocol? What do we do in a situation like that? Should we say goodbye now? And I'll tell you, you had a full life and I love you and you can go in peace. Or do you want to stay in line and I'll be with you till it's over? And she said, and she was able to, you know, first laugh and then say, no, let's say goodbye. And we did. And afterwards we continued to write each other through WhatsApp until until she wrote me that they're inside the house. And that's it. I wrote her, I'm with you. She wrote me, I feel you. And that was it.
And for a time, you believed, or you were told that she was taken, not killed?
Well, there wasn't a body to begin with. And the phone was geolocated in Gaza. So the assumption was that she was taken. But there wasn't a body because the house was burnt down completely. So it took them more than a month to find her remains in the house. She in the safe room. So yeah, there was more than a month, a period where when we were sure she was a hostage, that she was in Gaza. That was a very intense period of time. And, you know, I remember going to funerals of members of Be'eri because so many people have died. And I would hug, you know, a mother that just buried her son, and she would feel sorry for me. I didn't understand it. And she told me, you know, we have mechanisms to deal with loss, not with this uncertainty of a missing person, of someone who's been held hostage, of this continuous helplessness, right? When you lose someone, it's helplessness. I remember the feeling of helplessness, talking to her on the phone and not being able to do anything about it. But then it's over. Then you start mourning, you start processing, you can gain control on your narrative, or you can fight it. It's something you, but to the people who, after we realized she was dead, I understood what she was talking about, what the other mother was talking about.
Hmm. Have you been back since to Be'eri?
Yeah. I was there before they found her. I was looking in the safe room and I didn't see anything outside of wreckage. Only archaeologists could find the remains.
Did you have an angry period?
You know, sometimes I feel guilty for not being angry, but I can't say I had an angry period. I'm sad. I'm frustrated. I was helpless. Maybe I'm angry, you know, in the communal sense about, you know, the human species of us doing this to ourselves all the time. Because war is usually, it's circumstanceable. It's not fate. It's not something that has to happen. So I can get angry about that, about our choices. But in the personal sense, I don't think about the man who came in to her house and killed her. I don't think about him personally. I don't think, I know that it wasn't a person trying to kill my mother. We are all victims of these circumstances, of this ongoing violence and ongoing dehumanization. And I immediately, it was clear for me that the way for me to heal and the way for is to try and shape the reality around me so this kind of man won't feel he has to come into my mother's house and kill her.
How much time passed until you started being active in this way? And I imagine you were thinking or you were hearing your mother's voice when you took upon yourself to be so active in these kind of things.
Yeah, it was pretty immediate for me because I came into it. I came into it with established views about the situation. I didn't change the way I see things. October 7th. I just changed the way I act in the world. And after October 7th, I felt this urgency and a responsibility to not give in to just, oh, I'm just going to raise my kids, make money, live life as if life is sustainable, as if we can continue just living life beside occupation and conflict. And sadly, I received this status of being bereaved
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it comes with a responsibility, with a role to utilize it in order to promote change.
Laila, I want to go back to you now, because you knew Yonatan's mother, and it seems like you shared similar views. And I want to ask you what today are you hearing when you share your views with your community, people around you? Are you considered many people think of Vivian or people like Vivian, oh, they're crazy, there's no chance for peace, there's no chance for their activism. Do you face that kind of people saying things like that to you?
First of all, I want to say to Yonatan, I'm so sure that Vivian is so proud of you. And I know how much she will be happy to know what he's doing now, because she's always loved her life to do something like that. And my community, it's become much harder after the 7th of October to speak about peace. It was before, but it's now become much more difficult. Like, a lot of people came and they said to me, is this the peace that you talk about? Is those the people that you want us to have peace with them? And some of them, they called me a traitor, and some of them, they said that I make normalization. So it's not easy when you've been under occupation to deal with this kind of situation, especially after the genocide which happened in Gaza now. Like, every 2 minutes we have urgent news that there's a few people killed and they demolished a house and they arrested and they, many things come in every 1 minute. So sometimes I think I can't blame anyone about how they think about it, because this is so hard to think about or to understand, because everyone in the West Bank, or even the people who live inside Israel, the Palestinian who have Israeli nationality, all of them, they have relative in Gaza. And they feel sorry, and sometimes they feel angry about losing. Like, we have many family members in our organization. They lost, like, one of them, he lost 18 family members. And one of our friends, she lost the whole family of her sister, like, even the grandchildren, even the wives, the husband of the family. And it's still hard, but in our organization, we believe that whatever happened, we should continue, because these are the times that we should work harder. Not just when everything be quiet, we should just work together. No, this is the most important time that we should put our hands together and try to work much harder to convince other people. This is the way. Like, sometimes when I spoke about Vivian after she had been killed, and I told them how much she helped the Palestinian to go out from Gaza and help them to go to to hospital inside Israel, and how she put her life all the time for this kind of work and encourage everyone all the time. Like, once I have fight with another woman and she said to me, it's not a fight, but we like have an argue. And she said to me, please just listen and understand why she said that. Not everyone had the same thoughts or the same way to think about. And you will face many kind of people in your life. So you should take that deeply and think about it and don't be angry. This is one of the most important thing that I learned from her, and helped me really in my community too, to convince people. Like, when we start to talk about the war and what's going on, I said, so now after the war will end, what will happen to those people who lost their, like children in Gaza, who lost their houses, who lost their parents? What will happen to them? Think about the same inside Israel, about the children who lost their beloved ones, like their mother, their father, their family member, how they will think about. This is not the life that we want to our people or even to the Israeli cause. God created us to love each other and to live, not to kill each other. And it's not easy because we like swim against the tide.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not easy. And both sides, like even the Israeli side, I know that they face the same thing. And this is what I heard from colleagues.
So we're speaking in English, and we're creating this episode for people to hear your stories all around the world. I think it's time to say something about what do we want from them? What can we say to somebody listening to us? I don't know, in South America, in Australia, in Europe, and they know a little bit about the conflict, like you said earlier, Leila, but they don't know everything, and they don't know people. Is there something you want to tell audience around the world?
Yeah, of course. And this is the most question that I love, because always we have that question. And I always tell them that after you listen to our stories, please try to tell that to your community, to your friends, to your family, to tell them, because all the world now start to be involved in our conflict. And most of them, they didn't even know where we are in the map. So I want to tell them, don't pro-Israel, don't pro-Palestine, please pro-peace. This is what we want. And if they could convince their politician not to send weapons, this is not what we need. But if they use all that billions to create life, to create peace for both sides, this is what we want. This is what we need. And I know that the politician will never care about me or about Jonathan or about anyone. They just care about what they want, about the position that they want to get or the money that they want to, but they will never think about how we live our life, what we suffer daily from this occupation. And Jonathan, you said you didn't suffer from this occupation. No, you suffered from this occupation too, because what happened to your mother because of this occupation, what we now, this war about is about occupation. Like when you occupied people for more than 17 years, they don't have electricity, they don't have water, they don't have job, they don't have anything in their life. So imagine to live life like that. I don't say that I like agree what happened, but this is the natural thing when you've been under all that stress and you don't have anything to lose. You will do everything you think. And last thing that I want to say, that our children, our grandchildren, and we also deserve a normal life. They deserve to live like other people on this planet, to feel secure, to feel free, to feel happy. But imagine, like in this world, my youngest daughter, she's 8 years old. Once she painted something and she came to show it to me, and I was really shocked when I saw that she painted a house and there's a rocket in the sky. And there's people in the street, and all of them were gray. And I said, why you paint like that? And she said, because when the rocket hit the building, everything will be in gray. I was thinking, oh my God, like, this is not the way that she should think about. even in my village, because we didn't have shelters, we have like 10 rockets fell down in my village. We didn't know if it's from Hamas or from the Iron Dome. And she until now still feels terrified when she heard any kind of noise. This is not the life that I want for my children or my grandchildren or even for anyone in this world. And sometimes I ask myself why this happened and for what and for whom. Even if we want to end this occupation, and I know this will end one day, because if we will look to the history, all countries who have been under occupation ended. I don't know when, I don't know how, but I don't want to hear that call again to tell me, we are so sorry you lost your son or a beloved ones. Until today, my oldest son, now he's 21, and he worked in a company. He like a delivery. Sometimes he went to other cities like Ramallah or Jericho or Hebron. And I called him, I don't know how many times in a day, to ask him if he's okay. Like a month ago, he'd been in Hebron, and there's an attack between a Palestinian and a settler. And they closed the road from 12 in the afternoon until 9 in the evening. And imagine, like every 5 minutes, I call him, what's going on? And they even throw tear gas around them. And I told him, don't escape, because if you escape, maybe they will shoot you, stay whatever you now. And I don't want this life to my child. I don't want to wait every day. And this will cause health issues, really. Because if you're still under stress all your life, this is not the life that we want. If you are not part of solution, don't be part of the problem. Because, you know, sometimes people, when they try to involve themselves in our conflict, they make it much worse. Like when Trump tried to change the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, he thinks just, I want to bring it from here to here. No, this is not like that. That caused many, many other difficulties in our life.
Do you have a memory from Vivian that one of your meetings or something that you did together that you can share with us?
Last time when we met, we've been in the United States, in Washington, and I didn't know that she will be there, and even she didn't know. And when we saw each other, and we were really surprised, and we hug each other, we start to talk, we start to laugh. And the funniest thing that was at Christmas time, and me and her just standing there, and there are a few people who sing songs about Christmas. And I said to her, imagine a Muslim and a Jew celebrating Christmas. And we laugh a lot, and we eat chocolate together, and it was really the greatest time that we spent together.
I think that what the international community needs to recognize is that they weren't passive in this conflict for all these years. They were actively participating and enabling the occupation and the conflict. And that now, in terms of geopolitics, it became a bigger problem for the international community that the conflict is pursuing instead of ending. Then, because they were active in enabling it, they have a responsibility in stopping it. And they also have the power. It has to come from the ground, it's true. And in the end, Israeli and Palestinian leaders will sign an agreement. But the international community has the resources to push forward this capacity to get to an agreement in terms of conditions on aid and in terms of incentives and in terms of resources being directed into civil society and into political initiatives. No conflict, you know, most of the conflicts in the world aren't solved particularly between two sides if they are conflicts that affect geopolitics. Always there's a international intervention. And so that I mean in the political sphere, administrations, they have to create an international alliance to that has authority, that has the ability to offer incentives and to inflict sanctions. In terms of listeners, in terms of the just people, like Leila said, I get the feeling when I look at the discourse in the world that North Americans and Europeans are importing our conflict instead of exporting solutions to us. And when they talk in the same language as people here in Israel and Palestine talk, but they don't pay the prices and they don't know the they're not really informed in the this. So they have the privilege. I'm not saying it in criticism. I'm saying it as they have the privilege to promote a constructive idea instead of feeding into the destructive ideas that we collapsed into by living the conflict for so long. So like Leila said, being pro-Palestinian or being pro-Israel in North America and in Europe is not constructive to us, because Palestinians won't be free without peace, and Israelis won't be secure without peace. Nobody is going anywhere. Decolonization is a dream, is a fantasy. A complete right of return is also a fantasy. It's something we need to start imagining our shared future here in a sustainable way that ensures freedom and security for both peoples. And the only way to do it is to accept the fact that both peoples will continue to share the land. So we need legitimation, and we need the outsider to help us imagine that story and to pressure their administrations to offer us an anchor to hold on to. Offer political actors in Israel and Palestine to say, here, the international community is offering us a package and we're going to take it because it's going to create a better future for all of us.
Instead, they're just adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah. And I'm not saying they shouldn't demonstrate. You know, I think demonstrations are very powerful. I'm saying, like Leila said, they need to make the effort to march together, Jews and Muslims in North America and Europe, with a peace flag, mm-hmm. and not or both flags, not just pro side, because being pro one side will never get that side any further than where it is today.
Yeah, we have enough of that here.
Yeah.
Okay, friends, we'll wrap it up. Now, I want to thank both of you. If there's anything else you want to add before we go, this is the time. But I just want to say it was very, very interesting and very, very emotional to hear your stories. And I thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much. And I want to add something about what Jonathan said. I saw one of the demonstrations in the United States. There is Jews and Palestinian protest side by side, and this is what we want them to do, like protest with each other for one thing, to have peace and not ceasefire, because if we have ceasefire after 1 year or another year, we will have another war again, and this is not what we want. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for everything.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan, and I'm sad and happy to meet you at the same time, Leila.
I wish to meet you so soon, next one.
Yeah.
I think we will have better time, inshallah.
Yeah.
Thank you both.